In researching this topic, I came across this Reddit thread that caught my attention right away. It was focused on borderline personality disorder. And it was this ongoing conversation between a bunch of people who had been diagnosed with BPD, discussing its stigma and the impact it had on them, sometimes in unexpected ways. So I had a group of actors recreate this thread. Here it is.
Thread, BPD. Title, Why Do Health Professionals Hate BPD? Bertso, 84. I recently got diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. I've been in the hospital ever since the diagnosis, and I swear, ever since, I've been treated differently. The doctors, the nurses, literally everyone has been so short with me, to the point of being rude and uncomfortable. All of a sudden, it's like everyone sees me as a problem patient, and there's nothing I can do about it. I've gone out of my way to be pleasant and friendly, and it just seems to make things worse. This isn't my first hospital stay, and it's never been like this before. I'm convinced it's the diagnosis. What should I do?
Dan 93. Your first problem is you went to the hospital. They aren't set up to help us. They just put a band-aid on us and send us right back out the door.
Dash Tiger. It's the leprosy of mental health. The misunderstanding and the stigmatizing is so, so real. The worst part of it is the label, I swear.
Taylor Rott. Rude how? In my experience, medical staff are rarely rude and they're almost always busy. You're probably overanalyzing or projecting because of insecurity about your diagnosis.
FC33. The actual honest problem is that BPD is just more emotionally exhausting to work with than other mental illnesses. It breaks down the emotional defenses of the providers, and you're left with the more real and raw, normal human empathy they have left after their professionalism gets worn down. It sucks for us, but I think it's understandable.
Taylor Rott. Oh, yes. We are quick to judge others for supposedly judging us. But it's not doing anyone any favors.
Dash Tiger. Not really. You're overgeneralizing. There are people who don't have BPD who are nightmares to deal with, and people who do who are relaxed and polite, unless they're in crisis.
Bertso, 84. Exactly. I'm not being emotionally exhausting. What, with all my politeness? I've been very self-aware, especially since this all began, and I've done nothing to deserve this type of treatment.
Dash Tiger, it's not about you. It's about a system which throws around labels and the way those labels supersede the nuances of you as a person. It's dehumanizing.
FC33, maybe. I'm not arguing against the reality that labels can bring stigma. I've been given the borderline label as well. I get it. I'm just pointing out the reality that, assuming you have been accurately diagnosed, there are differences between us and everyone else. And those differences can make us more challenging to treat. Sure, I wish all the hospital staff knew us as individuals, but they don't have time to read our biographies. They're busy, many of them we see very briefly. So I'm just making the point that if they judge us based on our BPD, maybe it's not because they're evil. It's because that's all they have the capacity to know.
Taylor Rott. Right. Medical staff have generally chosen that career because they want to help others. If you're saying they're all against you, maybe that's not actually the problem. Maybe it's you.
Dan 93. Maybe it is the hospital. I went to the ER, and none of the medical nurses knew how to care for me or how to even talk to me. They just waited for me to calm down, sent me on my way.
Dash Tiger, we're saying the same thing. The system doesn't support us as individuals in the way it should. We are cogs in a machine. Let's hope it evolves in a way that serves us.
Taylor Rott. Yeah, agreed. Let's root for that. Rather than blame the exhausted nurses who spent maybe the last 11 hours providing care to 20 patients.
My name is Tobin Richardson. I'm a counselor educator with a vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. And here we're digging into dialectical behavior therapy, what's usually just referred to as DBT. DBT was developed by Marsha Lenahan in the late 80s, and its original purpose was to treat individuals with borderline personality disorder, especially those with chronic suicidal thoughts and self-harm. But it's since been adapted for a wide range of issues. It includes the development of skills, including mindfulness, distress tolerance, emotional regulation, and interpersonal effectiveness. And it works. It works really well. There's a lot of evidence to support it, and it's convinced a lot of therapists to incorporate it into their practice in a way that's foundational to their clinical work. And one of the therapists who has seen the impact of DBT firsthand over and over again is Katie K. May. Katie owns and directs a group practice that specializes in working with teens who are coping with depression and self-harm and thoughts of suicide. She's seen DBT work, sometimes with very high-risk clients that other therapists had turned away. Here's Katie.
But at the root of that, it's an emotion regulation treatment. So it's really focused, different than CBT, which is very focused on like change your thoughts, change your feelings. I know that's an oversimplification, but like DBT is focused on your emotions and how your emotions drive your behaviors. And the foundation of that is something called the biosocial theory. And this is how it relates to borderline personality disorder, is that the bio part of biosocial is your biology. And the people that are a good fit for DBT are highly sensitive. There are people that might react like 0 to 60 in 10 seconds flat. And it takes them a really long time to calm down after that. So when you have someone with that biological sensitivity, here's the social part of biosocial, and you put them in an environment that might invalidate them, that might not understand their high needs according to their emotions, or might say things that aren't affirming that, then you get this chronic inability to manage your emotions. And that's who DBT is really helpful for. So sometimes that is someone with borderline personality disorder. Sometimes that is, in my case, in my center, it's a lot of teenagers with unformed frontal lobes who just like have difficulty with emotion regulation. A lot of times now we're seeing ADHD and autistic clients who are a really good fit for DBT and in an affirming way. And so I think it's really anyone who struggles to manage big emotions. And that's not just people with borderline personality disorder, but it does include them. When I started in the field, so way back when I started, my first job post-graduation was as a therapist in a partial hospital program. And my interest was in expressive arts. I got trained in play therapy, but mostly my work moving into the outpatient setting was working with teenagers, and I was really good at connecting with them. I was really good at like expressive arts and helping them feel understood and building that rapport. And so I was doing some great work building that rapport with my teen clients. And I was coming up against this block, I would say, again and again, where they would be coming in with their self-harm, willing to talk about it, willing to explore it, but I didn't really know how to get them to that next step. I didn't know how to get them to those change strategies or to really see some of that forward movement and traction. And I had had one prior DBT, I would say like introductory workshop when I was working at the partial hospital. And so that came back to me and I was thinking, I really need something that's not just acceptance, that's not just validation, that actually helps me make some changes or work on my clients to work with my clients to make these changes. And that's where I fell back into DBT and started doing more training, working with a DBT consultant so I could have a better footing for how to use this in my sessions. And that's one of the things that I love the most about DBT, is that it's not one or the other. It's not just being humanistic or showing up for your client and holding space. It is that, but it's also helping them move towards the changes that they want to make so they can have a life that's worth living for them. So that's where DBT became really important to me. I'm great at connecting with teens, but how do I actually help them, you know?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So did you feel like that, because I feel like for a lot of people, when they think of DBT, the thing that they do think about like really strong emotions, I think it makes sense to apply that to that population. Did you start to find it worked in ways you didn't expect it, with client-based, like clients you didn't expect it to over time?
I would say as a new therapist, one of the challenges in that was implementing change strategies when I hadn't previously, right? So having this like box of what therapy meant for me and my clients, and then wanting to bring in more skills or wanting to be a little bit more structured. So from the person of the therapist side, that would be a surprise that I experienced was my own discomfort of, I know this is something that's going to be helpful for my clients, but how is this going to shift the dynamic of what's happening in therapy and how is it going to be received? And when I actually started doing it, I noticed that my clients wanted it. They you know, who would have thought they wanted to feel better? They wanted to be helped. And so they were soaking in all of the practical and concrete. And it wasn't that we were giving up holding that space, being validating, doing expressive activities, but we were bringing in this other side to help them feel better. And so I did have that personal fear. And I think that's just part of who I am. You know, my own personality of making changes and shifting things can feel hard. But once I started integrating it, I really did start seeing improvements with my clients. And one of the things that we do in DBT is we track behaviors and emotions so we can not only feel what's happening in the session as improvement, but we can see it like a graph.
How much of DBT is psychoeducation?
25%. And that's okay. Not just like a number that I'm pulling out. So there's this common misconception when people hear DBT, they think of a DBT skills group. And DBT skills group is one out of the four components of DBT that make it effective. And so psychoeducation is that skills group where clients are coming in, they're learning a skill, they're rehearsing it within the context of that group, they're practicing it for homework, and they're coming back the next week and repeating that process again. But outside of that, a lot of what DBT is validation. There are 7 levels of validation that we learn and practice in DBT. It's a lot of assessment. If anyone's ever heard the term behavior chain, so there's a specific assessment process that we go through in DBT, but a lot of it is understanding what is the function of a behavior, what's driving it, what's the emotion underlying it, what happens as a result, like how is it helpful for the client, what's maintaining that behavior. So there's this really thorough assessment process that happens. And then there's all these strategies that we can bring in to start that, to help the client see change. One of them being skills, but there's also exposure. There's also cognitive modification, which is a lot of like cognitive restructuring, CBT type stuff. There's also looking at your environment, which again, working with teens, that's super important because teens live in a house with a family. But in any environment, looking at how is your partner reinforcing your behaviors or responding in a way that actually might be triggering to you. So we're looking at this whole host of variables to help the client. And one of those variables is helping them learn new skills to be effective. And I have a lot of employees on my team who run skills group. I've been a therapist for 8 years. I personally, I hope the DBT police aren't listening, I feel bored running skills groups. It's like the same thing over and over again. And so I think like just hearing what you're saying, that part of treatment, I love that other people on my team do, because I get to do the like understanding the patterns and figuring out the behaviors and like digging into things with my client in individual sessions, which is so much more fulfilling for me as a therapist.
What are other misconceptions? Are there other ones that you've heard around DBT?
Yeah. So another one, because in DBT, we do phone coaching, and what phone coaching is the ability for a client when they've tried their skills that they have in their repertoire and they're not helpful or effective in that moment, or maybe they're too overwhelmed and they can't even remember what their crisis plan is or what their skills are, that they have the ability to connect with their therapist outside of that 1 hour a week in individual and 90 minutes a week in group. So they have access to their therapist between sessions. It's an important part of DBT because it's how we generalize behaviors. So one of the selling points that I always make in DBT is that we help you use skills when you actually need them and not in the controlled, safe environment of an office only, which of course it's easy to be skillful when, you know, you're just you and your therapist. So the misconception that comes with that is that if you decide to learn DBT and be a DBT therapist, that you have to be always on, that you have to be always available, or that you're always a crisis line. And that's completely inaccurate. It's one of the biggest myths I have to debunk in order to bring new people onto my team, because they fear that they're never going to get a break. But one of the pieces of learning to be a DBT therapist is learning to observe your own limits. And it's very specific phrasing. It's not learning to set boundaries with clients, because a boundary is a fixed rule about what one of you can or can't do and how the other will respond. But observing limits is more flexible. And what that looks like for me as a therapist is saying, I'm awake typically around 8 a.m. and I go to sleep typically around 11 p.m. You can reach out to me at any time during that period. However, if I'm with my family, I'm not looking at my phone. If I'm with another client, I'm not looking at my phone. Just like when I'm with you, I'm not looking at my phone. So you need to have A, B, and C skill stacked and tried, and you're not just going immediately to some target behavior because I didn't pick up my phone. And I like to remind people that DBT was created in 1993 when there were no cell phones, when you couldn't just text someone, when literally like you were leaving messages on voicemails of somebody's home landline. So we weren't as available back then as we are now. So this idea of observing limits also means I'm going on vacation with my family and I won't be answering my phone. What are you going to do in the next week to make sure that you're using your skills plan? Because I won't be able to answer you. So it allows you to be so much more human and to have these kinds of conversations with your clients and to make sure that they have the skills to be effective in their lives without relying on you, but knowing that when you're available, you're there to support the process.
What are the other, so have we covered all the tenets of DBT? Are there ones we're missing?
So we have the skills group we talked about a little bit. We have phone coaching. The other thing that is important as part of the orientation process, which I alluded to, is the diary card. And the diary card is a tracking tool that's used with clients. It typically includes their emotions throughout the week. So they're rating on a daily basis, like 1 to 5, 1 to 10, or checking off which ones they experience. You get to kind of co-create with your client what makes sense. It also includes a target behavior, 1 to 3 target behaviors. So these are the behaviors that you're working on in treatment. And we specifically use the term target behavior to kind of generalize amongst the kind of self-destructive behaviors our clients might have, like cutting or binging or, substance use, things like that. And then we're also tracking what skills you use. So if we're putting all those pieces together, we're looking at what were your emotions, what were your urges and actions in conjunction with those emotions, and what skills did you try in those moments? And the client brings that diary card to each session, or in many cases, like in ours, it's like a digital diary card that we can access collaboratively. And it allows us to set the agenda for the session. And this is helpful for many reasons. One, it lets us prioritize what we're working on in treatment, and it gives us some guidance, because we know, especially with our highly clients with high emotion, clients who are mood dependent, of course they don't want to talk about the thing that's bringing them a lot of shame or that might be really difficult to talk about. So it helps us together to prioritize what's most important in treatment. And it prevents some of what I've heard other therapists talk about, like doorknob confessionals. Like I talked about my friend in my beach house for 40 minutes. And then at the doorknob, I was like, oh yeah, I tried to self-harm this week or something like that. And then we can't address it. So it helps us to really make sure that we're getting to the most important things in treatment in that week. And also there's flexibility within that, but the diary card is reviewed in every session.
Can you give us just an idea of like what those skills tend to look like?
Yeah, so it's very person dependent. I'm going to answer your question and then answer outside of the question. I will say like one of the skills that's recommended a lot and that tends to help a lot of our clients is called the TIP skill. And everything in DBT is an acronym, and TIP stands for temperature, like putting ice on your face or taking a hot shower, intense exercise, jumping jacks, running up and down the stairs, paced breathing, like very slow breathing, and then progressive muscle relaxation. And so oftentimes when someone's in a state of high arousal, they're not in a place to solve the problem. And so we're wanting to regulate their body physiology before we move into any kind of problem solving or even any kind of like distract skills. I know I can speak for myself, like when I'm in a state of high activation, I'm not able to really even like talk to someone about what's going on. I need to calm my body down first. And so that's what that skill is all about. And we recommend it a lot. That being said, and then I find myself saying this to parents a lot when they say like, what's the skill that Johnny should be using? And I'm like, well, it really depends. And so that's where we're using more assessment. So I'm understanding that if Johnny is self-harming, but right before he self-harms, he feels this strong loneliness, then maybe part of his skill is texting a friend or hopping on video games so that he can play Fortnite with the other people that are playing Fortnite. And so we're really wanting to match the skill to the client need and the client's level of activation. So anyone can learn DBT. There is a treatment manual. It's a dense read, but I recommend at least having it as a reference. There are a lot of trainings out there from different people who teach DBT through their lens. So that's what I would say is most important, is not necessarily just like learning DBT and getting your continued ed credits, because you can really do that anywhere. But the magic comes in having consultation following that for actually applying what you're learning. So I've seen, you know, because I lead a team and I have give or take 20 clinicians at any time that are on my team, I see the trajectory of learning is that they get the information, they get the theory, they learn how to do DBT, so to speak. But then they start sitting with clients and applying DBT, and that's when all the questions come up. And that's when they see that, oh yeah, DBT in theory works when it's, I guess, like a lab-like setting, right? Like with any of these treatments, we're learning it as if it's, you know, one model and for one person. But once we start seeing a bunch of people and we see how it needs to work differently, that's when I think you need the most support. And so I would recommend continued consultation. So one of the things that I see a lot when I'm training new people on my team is the fear. So when you're working with a very high risk population, which often people who need DBT are high risk, they've had multiple suicide attempts, they might have some really scary self-harm. And so it's going to bring up a lot, especially in a new therapist. And I think there's probably going to be a little bit of imposter syndrome, or like, can somebody else do this better than me if they're better trained than me? And so I really like to name that if you're learning DBT, you are learning the evidence-based gold standard treatment for helping these clients. You don't have to have every answer, but if you're following the treatment and you're getting consultation, you are going to do, I don't want to say a better job than another therapist, but you're going to do a great job with the client that's in front of you. And I do want to say better than maybe someone down the street who doesn't have the DBT training and they're, you know, just if they're doing general therapy. And so I really want to empower any new therapist who's learning DBT to lean into that fear, to give themselves permission to just be a little bit ahead of your client with supervision and consultation, of course, but that it is going to be scary. And I notice a lot of people who gravitate towards DBT worked in higher levels of care. They're used to this different kind of team or a locked unit that feels safer when you're working with high-risk clients. And so there's some personal work to be done there. And then I think about those types of clients that probably have been fired by a lot of other therapists because of their high-risk capacity. And so just being the therapist who's willing to be afraid and do it anyway is helping them more than some other therapist already has.
Yeah, I love that. Are there other, like, I mean, just from being in your role, like in consultation, are there other things that have, are there types of situations that come up that you see a lot in consultation?
I'll speak to, so in, specifically in working with teens and with families, which I think can look a little bit different. There's also the pressure of parents that comes in. And this might also be true for if you're working with adults, but you're not interacting as much with partner or family. But if you're working with high-risk teenagers, parent pressure becomes a big part of what you need to navigate as a therapist. And so I always go back to looking at the function of behavior as my first thing. Well, if a parent is quote-unquote pressuring you, which they're not, they're just feeling their own emotions and it's coming, it's like seeping out in sessions, it's because they're scared. It's because they don't know how to help. It's because they're feeling shame or, you know, figuring out their own family of origin stuff and how it's leaking into their own family. So there's a lot of other pieces, especially when you're working with youth, that need to be considered. And what we do at my practice is have a parent DBT group, and it runs concurrent to our teen groups and our teen DBT, because again, going back to that environment piece, is you can only do so much with your clients, but the environment is such a powerful piece of what's actually helping to shift behaviors. And that's true no matter what age you are. You can help a client be as skillful as possible, but if you keep putting them back into an environment that requires them to do things in a way that's not so effective or adaptive, because that's the only way that they can get heard, or that's the only way they know how to get their needs met, well, then it's an undoing of the process. And so I think that's something that I want to make clear about working with teens, is you have to feel comfortable working with parents. And I know a lot of teen therapists get into the field because they want to work with teenagers and not with parents. But I also want to make the more general message clear that you only have so much power to help your clients create change. And so don't put so much pressure on yourself either.
Yeah. That's a good reminder. Can you talk any more about, I'm also just really now curious about the groups. I feel like these teen DBT groups are probably, in my head, interesting. Like, how do those usually play out?
Yeah. So for groups for us, we're always doing an intake first, an individual intake. Every group client has an individual therapist. So we're really clear on the front end that group is like a classroom-like setting. It's not therapy. It's not a process group. You're coming in and you're learning skills. And so every group starts with mindfulness. And this, for us, it's more like interactive activities or movement-based or ways that we can really engage teens. And then we move into homework review, which is the accountability piece. And this is, how did it go? What skill did you work on? Did it work? Did it not work? Let's coach you. If it didn't work, let's support you in the process. For teenagers, I would say 80% of them have done their homework. Of that 80%, a few of them are faking it. They didn't do their homework, but they're thinking of it on the fly. Whatever. They're still participating. But that's one of those places where I would say, like, show up with what's in the room. Be willing to be flexible. It's not going to be perfect. Then we're practicing new skills, and that looks like learning the skill, learning to apply it. Maybe it's a role play, maybe it's an activity, maybe we're watching a video clip of what it looks like. And then from there, we're also discussing the skill and then assigning that skill for homework for them to practice in the week ahead. Overall, that is the general structure of group. Have we had people run away from group? Yes. Have we had people that shut down in group? Yes. I mean, I think you can expect the spectrum of things that you'd expect from any client with emotion dysregulation has happened in a group. And it can be really rewarding and really fun. And it can also be really challenging and sometimes lead to burnout. For DBT, there's two group leaders. So there's always a lead and a co-lead that are flip-flopping roles. One of them is doing the facilitation of group, and one of them is managing those group dynamics. And so that feels really important, because when we have had a client who maybe is vaping in the bathroom or says they're going to the bathroom and then leaves the building, we have someone else there that can help to manage those pieces. It would be really challenging with, we have average 8 members a group, for one therapist to manage all of that while also teaching, while also facilitating group.
Is there like a time frame that people typically go kind of through this process, or is it just an ongoing as needed?
Yeah, there is a time frame. So a full round of DBT skills for us is 24 weeks. I think that's standard to most programs. So it's a 6-month program, and we recommend 2 rounds. So the first round is really learning the skills, and the second round is generalizing the skills. So the way that we describe it is, like, first time through, you're learning everything. Second time through, it's becoming more automatic for you, so you don't have to think about it as much, and it's just a part of your life. I would say most people complete at least 1 round. Many people complete 2. A few people have completed 3. Some people have stayed throughout high school. So for us, it's been a mixed bag, but definitely that first 6-month cycle, we say, is really important.
As Katie mentioned, DBT is based on the idea that emotional dysregulation comes from a combination of biological vulnerability and then an invalidating environment. While DBT was developed for borderline personality disorder, again, it's effective in way more clinical contexts. The most evidence exists to support its treatment in things like self-harm and suicidal behaviors and PTSD, and also substance use disorders and eating disorders. The foundation of DBT is the idea of balancing acceptance and change. DBT teaches people how to accept themselves and their emotions while learning practical skills to improve emotional regulation and tolerate distress and build healthier relationships. And this is why it's so useful for people with intense emotions and populations that might be difficult to otherwise treat. DBT isn't magic, but it is the culmination of a lot of different things that work, that we know work. And things that work may almost feel like magic, especially to clients who need support the most.